Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network's Middle East Studies podcast. I'm Ruben Silverman, a researcher at Stockholm University's Institute for Turkish Studies, and with me today is Vladimir Hamid Troyansky, an assistant professor of global studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book, Empire of Refugees, North Caucasian Muslims and the Late Ottoman State, has just been published by Stanford University Press, and we'll be discussing it today. First, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast and ask you if you can talk a little bit about your own experiences and how those experiences led you to study the experiences of other people, people from the North Caucasus region in the 19th century. I'd love to hear about that.
Thank you very much, Ruben. It's wonderful to be here and to speak with you. I'm a historian of migration in the Middle East and the broader Muslim world. And my book, Empire of Refugees, is a transimperial history of migration. It examines the resettlement of about 1 million Muslim refugees from the Russian Empire in the Ottoman Empire. It tells the story of how these refugees transformed the Middle East, and also how the two empires managed Muslim migration, especially how the Ottomans built a Muslim refugee regime. How did I get interested in this topic? It is my first book, and it is based on my doctoral dissertation at Stanford. Before graduate school, I briefly lived in Damascus and in Cairo. I was studying Arabic there. And it was in Syria where I first heard about Syria's Circassian diaspora and Chechen diaspora and Dagestani diaspora. And since then, I've been keenly aware of this diaspora originating in the Caucasus and now living throughout the Middle East. And I was struck that so many people in the region were familiar with the presence of Circassians and other North Caucasians in their societies. But the story of this massive diaspora, one of the largest in the Middle East, and how it came to be, was mostly unknown to the general public and also not very well known in the English language academia. So I came to graduate school to, to study 20th century Syria, but I eventually gravitated towards the late Ottoman Empire and this topic. And I always wanted to focus on migration. I've always been fascinated about the issues of citizenship and identity and belonging because those topics are very personal to me. So I always wanted to work on one's world-making and meaning-making in diaspora. And for this topic, which is so transnational, I structured my fieldwork in such a way that I could visit different places and archives and approach the story of migration from different angles. So in my fieldwork, I first went to Jordan, then I spent some time in Turkey, then I traveled to Bulgaria and Romania, where Circassian refugees used to live in the 19th century, and then I spent time in the Caucasus, both the South Caucasus republics and in the North Caucasus within the Russian Federation. This book is about North Caucasian refugees. It also tells the origins of organized refugee resettlement in the Middle East. And right now, as we're recording this interview, we're living in a pretty dark timeline. Understanding histories of displacement and of ethnic cleansing and of sectarian violence and of settler colonialism, and also thinking about what it took people to survive is very important. And these themes, so fundamental to shaping our modern world, very much motivated me when I was writing this book.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, so in the book, you're talking about events that happened primarily in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. But maybe we can step back first and sort of set the scene for people listening to this podcast and talk a little bit about who these people were and what this term North Caucasus meant in this period. People who are coming from this region to the Ottoman Empire, would they have thought of themselves as North Caucasian at this time? Or did that experience come as a part of this movement? And really, why was this movement happening at this time? What was happening in the 1860s to drive this process?
The North Caucasus is a region between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, and as the name suggests, it lies to the north of the Caucasus Mountains. So today, the entire region lies within Russia, and it's divided into many autonomous republics that were established in the Soviet period on the ethnic principle. The South Caucasus, correspondingly, is south of the mountains, and today it's the sovereign countries of Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. Now, in the early modern period, the more important geographic divide was actually not north-south, but west-east, right? The West Caucasus had closer ties to the Ottoman Empire and the Crimean Khanate, and the East Caucasus had greater cultural ties with Iran. So this difference was reflected in dominant literary languages, in legal schools of Islamic thought, in different Sufi networks, in different parts of the Caucasus. But the main division became north-south because of Russia's imperial conquest, which was ongoing since the 18th century. Russia first incorporated or occupied areas to the south of the Caucasus Mountains, several Christian Georgian principalities and Muslim Khanates. And by 1828, the entire South Caucasus was within the Russian Empire, but many areas in the North Caucasus were not. So then we get the so-called Caucasus War, which Russia waged for the control of the entire region. And it waged this war between 1817 and 1864 against indigenous Muslim communities in the North Caucasus. This war sped up after the Crimean War, in which Russia was defeated by the Ottomans, the British, and the French. In 1859, Russia broke the resistance of the Caucasus Imamat, which is modern-day Chechnya and Dagestan, and the only areas left to conquer were in the Northwest Caucasus, territories of Circassians. So Circassians included many different communities that spoke the Circassian language, or Adige. And then in the final years of that Caucasus War, in 1863 and 1864, the Russian military perpetrated an ethnic cleansing of Circassians. The military burnt villages, which prompted this massive flight to the Black Sea coast. And within 2 years, up to 500,000 Western Circassians, or 90% of the entire Western Circassian population, became refugees. This assault was really brutal. And the contemporaries' accounts are horrifying. Since the 1990s, many Circassian activists in the Middle East, in diaspora, and in the Caucasus call for the recognition of these events as genocide. Now, Russia had long had Muslim communities. Muslims have been the second largest religious community in Russia since the mid-16th century. So what happened in the North Caucasus? Like, why this violence? The Russian military chose to violently expel people to bring the war to an end and to ensure that Russia could hold the strategic coast, which it then quickly colonized with Christian settlers. And the identity of refugees as Muslims and as Circassians was not irrelevant in Russia's decision to expel, because the military and also the civil authorities expected indigenous Muslim populations to sympathize with the Ottoman Empire. I find that this category of loyalty, or rather perceived loyalty to the empire, was a very important category in migration policies, both for the Russians and for the Ottomans. Okay, now let's move on. Let's see what happens after 1864. After 1864, many more North Caucasian Muslims fled to the Ottoman Empire. Chechens, Ingush, Ossetians, Abazins, Avars, Karachais, Balkars, and many others. Dagestan alone, which lies on the Caspian coast, has several dozen ethnic groups. And this emigration to the Ottoman Empire after 1864 extended to virtually every ethnic and social group. People were emigrating for different reasons, but the main reason was that so many communities were dispossessed through Russia's land reforms, or they were pushed out by new Christian settlers and new laws that destroyed their indigenous cultural and political institutions. Did refugees consider themselves North Caucasians at the time? No, the trans-regional North Caucasian identity comes later. It really formed in diaspora in the Ottoman Empire. Overall, between the 1850s and World War I, about 1 million Muslims fled the North Caucasus as refugees to the Ottoman Empire.
Well, so this raises the question that I wanted to ask, which is the Ottoman Empire to which they're coming, there's already Circassians there. There's some famous ones I can think of, famous governors and things like that, sultan's wives, this type of thing. So what was the place or understanding or status of North Caucasians in the empire up to this point where 1 million people come?
So the Ottoman government, first of all, I have to say, the Ottoman government welcomed Muslim refugees, right? The arrival of Circassian refugees in the 1860s was the largest refugee crisis the Ottomans had experienced until that. And the Ottomans had a fairly good idea who Circassians were. Circassians lived on the margins of the Ottoman world for centuries and used to be a fixture of Ottoman society, primarily through the institution of Circassian slavery. So slavery in the Ottoman Empire was racialized, and enslaved Circassians and Abkhazians and Georgians were often trafficked to harems and to elite urban households. Some enslaved male individuals or male descendants of enslaved people came to occupy senior administrative and military positions in the Ottoman Empire. As you said, some of the governors by the 19th century, as far away as Ottoman Tunisia, like were of North Caucasian origin. But by the 19th century, the supply of enslaved Circassians on the slave market was all but gone. But the Ottoman public by that point had formed the perception of who a Circassian or Cherkess was. Someone urban, typically part of the Ottoman elite, and usually of enslaved origin. Now, this story, the story of the mid-19th century in the 1860s, changes all of that. The perception of who Circassian is transformed throughout the empire. It's no longer an elite and an urban person, but a destitute refugee. And in the coming decades, there will be another perception of Circassian as a rural bandit, because refugee economies in the countryside would deteriorate. Now, a few more words about enslavement. The Circassian refugee crisis of the 1860s actually reinforced the institution of Ottoman slavery. During this awful humanitarian crisis, refugees were arriving from the Caucasus to Ottoman ports. Refugees were starving, they were dying of hunger, of epidemic disease. And at that moment, slave merchants moved into the ports and they were purchasing many individuals. So what happens next is that there's the supply of enslaved Circassians that bloated the Ottoman slave market and prices fell. And many people who could not afford owning slaves before now could. By that point, Circassian slavery, which was an old but dying institution, got a new breath of life. And many more elites in the empire became invested in preserving slavery. It's a horrifying story. But the displacement from the Caucasus is a major reason why slavery as a legal institution survived all the way until the end of the Ottoman Empire. I also want to say a few words about the impact of the story in the 1860s and about the Ottoman resettlement of refugees. The government settled North Caucasians in almost every province of the empire, like through the northern and eastern Balkans, and in every province in Anatolia. The major exceptions, really, were North Africa, Hejaz, Yemen, and very few refugees were allowed to settle in Palestine and Lebanon. By World War I, North Caucasians settled in over 1,100 villages. And most of those villages were brand new, established by refugees themselves. So by the mid-19th century, the Ottomans have a completely different understanding of who Circassians are because of those refugee villages coming up everywhere. And my book shows that the resettlement of Muslim refugees transformed the Ottoman Empire. On the one hand, it accelerated the collapse of Ottoman rule in the Balkans because of how badly the government mismanaged the resettlement there. And on the other hand, It reinforced Ottoman rule in many outlying regions in Anatolia and in the Levant, especially in nomadic areas. Refugee migration profoundly changed the empire's demographics, its political economy, and also how the Ottoman officials thought of what the Ottoman Empire could be, empire of refugees.
Indeed. One way you talk about this, and you mentioned it earlier, is the concept of refugee regime, right? So faced with these hundreds of thousands, a million refugees, you argue that the Ottomans developed a particular type of refugee regime. Maybe we can talk about this term a little bit more. What were some of its elements, its institutions, its policies, its concepts?
The main argument of the book is that between 1860 and World War I, the Ottoman government constructed a refugee regime. So what is a refugee regime? A refugee regime is a set of principles, norms, and procedures governing the acceptance and resettlement of refugees. Typically, when we talk about a refugee regime, we think about the 20th century, an international refugee regime set up by the United Nations after World War II, with the 1951 Refugee Convention as the key document anchoring this regime. Several historians showed that in the interwar era, the League of Nations inaugurated what can be described as the first international refugee regime. What my book shows is that in the second half of the 19th century, a Muslim country, the Ottoman Empire, was offering what is remarkably similar to refugee protections one might expect today. The Ottomans ended up admitting virtually every Muslim refugee, not only from the Caucasus, but also from the Crimea, the Balkans, Crete, and North Africa. Now, what was the legislative basis of this regime? There were two main laws, the Immigration Law of 1857 and the Land Code of 1858. The Immigration Law allowed immigration in the Ottoman Empire to everyone, irrespective of their religion. It was a very liberal legislation. The Ottomans wanted European farmers to immigrate and to bring their capital, to establish farms, to become productive taxpayers. So in this sense, the Ottoman Empire wanted to compete with the United States and other countries in the Americas for European immigrants. The immigration law guaranteed free land and temporary benefits. For example, exemptions from taxation and from military service for 6 to 12 years. Now, the Land Code of 1858 standardized land tenure and land ownership throughout the empire. The government wanted to make Ottoman land practices legible to foreign investors and to centralize state control over much of agricultural land. And this legislation was favorable to immigrants. It allowed the government to confiscate from local populations the land that was not registered or that was not paid tax on. And the government would then give this land to refugees in the hope that one day they would pay tax. Okay, now about the main institution in this regime. To handle the arrival of hundreds of thousands of refugees from Russia, the Ottoman government founded the Ottoman Refugee Commission in 1860. And this organization then took this legislation for immigrants and built on it to construct a refugee regime. Because refugees escaping Russia arrived with nothing. They just fled an ethnic cleansing. They had very different needs than the European immigrants that the Ottomans had envisioned. So in addition to exemptions and the free land, the Refugee Commission also provided subsidies to refugees, financial aid, and grain to survive in the first couple of years. The ideological basis for this refugee regime was the Ottoman Empire's, as the Ottoman Caliphate's, responsibility to protect Muslims wherever they lived. At the core of this refugee regime was the idea of hijrah. Hijra is the journey of the Prophet Muhammad from Mecca to Medina in the 7th century to preserve the young Muslim community. Later in Islamic history, this concept became to mean a migration of Muslims living in a territory under non-Muslim rule to a Muslim territory, and it was widely interpreted as a religious obligation. In the 19th century, Hijra became an anti-colonial movement because so many Muslims were fleeing European conquest and occupation, primarily to the Ottoman Empire. And Muslim refugees called themselves Muhajir, which can be translated into English as refugee, immigrant, and emigrant. In the 19th century, this term had a very strong religious heritage, and Muslim refugees from the Caucasus and from Crimea and from the Balkans used this term exclusively to refer to themselves and to communicate their needs to the Ottoman Empire. So this refugee regime, it permeated Ottoman bureaucracy. It wasn't just the refugee commission. It encompassed the work of Ottoman ministries of interior, finance, trade and agriculture, public education, forestry, charitable endowments. By the 1880s, every Ottoman province had its own refugee resettlement committee with subcommittees on sub-provincial and district levels and land survey committees. So thousands of Ottoman officials were at all times working on refugee resettlement. This refugee resettlement also involved many ordinary Ottoman subjects. For example, charity was an important element of the refugee regime. Officials and the palace and local Muslim, Christian, and Jewish communities were donating money and labor to refugees. Petitioning was another critical part of the refugee regime because it grounded it. Refugees were sending thousands of petitions to be heard. It was very important for them to know that they could speak to the government and then the officials would listen to their concerns. So through all of this, over half century, the Ottoman Refugee Commission evolved into one of the world's largest resettlement agencies. It resettled anywhere between 3 and 5 million Muslim refugees by World War I, mostly refugees from Russia and the Balkans. So this is the refugee regime for Muslims, and the Ottomans guaranteed admission and resettlement for any displaced Muslim. In the meantime, the Ottomans still had their immigration system through which non-Muslims, foreign Christians, and foreign Jews could enter the Ottoman Empire. Their admission was governed by that immigration law of 1857. And some non-Muslims did immigrate. So that's, for example, the story of Jewish migration to Ottoman Palestine. But non-Muslims were not resettled by the Refugee Commission. They were not granted refugee subsidies, and their admission was not guaranteed. They had to negotiate it. So that is the main difference between the Ottoman refugee regime and the Ottoman immigration system.
Hmm. So in talking about the Refugee Commission and applications to it and petitions, we start to get some sense of some of the archival sources that you're probably dealing with. And you've mentioned the wide array of countries you went to do research for this, but maybe we could talk just a little bit more about some of the archives and documents you're drawing on, because it's not just those documents. So if you could talk a little bit more about the archives you drew on and the case studies you chose, I'd be interested in that as well.
So Empire of Refugees is based on research in the post-Ottoman side of the border. I did research in Jordan, Turkey, Bulgaria, and Romania. On the post-Tsarist side of the border, I did research in Russia, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. And I also did research in the UK and the United States. My main research languages are Arabic, modern Ottoman Turkish, and Russian. And I also use sources in Bulgarian and French. I worked with a variety of documents, which has been very exciting for this project. Empire of Refugees is the history of migration, and it operates on two levels. So on one level, it's a study of Ottoman and Russian migration policies. And for this story, I was reconstructing how legislation and policies evolved, ultimately how migration policies propped up imperial governance. And I used many state records. I used government correspondence, of course, in Ottoman, Turkish, and in Russian. I used documents of the Ottoman Refugee Commission in Istanbul, which only became available to researchers in the last decade. I used Sharia court records in Arabic in Jordan. And it's really an incredible type of source that to study the daily life in the Ottoman Empire. In Bulgaria, in Sofia, I used tax registers and population registers. Again, a very underused and great source for social and economic history. Some of the Ottoman records at the National Library in Sofia are still uncatalogued. Some of them had never even been opened I recall one population register on which a 19th century thread, keeping it closed, had to be cut for me by an archivist. I also was very fortunate to gain access to land records, a rare type of source for the late 19th century, land records for the entire Amman area, which is kept in the Jordanian Ministry of Interior. Like for 3 weeks, I was sitting in this government office and I was taking notes in pencil. I was not allowed a camera or a phone of all the land transactions that took place in Ottoman Amman. And I've seen some police protocols in Russian in the Caucasus. Okay, so that's one side of the story. The other side of the story is that Empire of Refugees is a bottom-up history of resettlement. I was looking for refugee voices and documents that showed how refugees experienced their displacement and their resettlement. And for many years, I've been collecting private letters that refugees wrote. Private letters are a really unique source to study migration in the Ottoman Middle East. And many private letters are preserved in family collections. So I found letters in Arabic and in Ottoman Turkish that refugees' descendants held on to for so many years, especially in Jordan. And in the book, I have an entire family history of the Hutat family that is reconstructed from 58 letters in Ottoman Turkish that were written in the late 19th century. In addition to private letters, I looked at petitions, hundreds of petitions that refugees wrote. People would write petitions to the Russian government before immigration and to the Ottoman government during resettlement. And as I mentioned, petitioning was such an important part of the Ottoman refugee regime. Refugees expected officials to hear them. So petitioning as a genre is fascinating because refugees were coaching their concerns in a certain way when writing to district governors, provincial governors, the refugee commission, the Grand Vizier, or the Sultan himself. And I also did interviews. I conducted interviews with descendants of Circassian and Chechen refugees in Jordan and Turkey. And their recollections, they very much complemented my archival work. So how did I think about constructing my fieldwork? I picked geographic case studies first. So I knew that I wanted to look at three specific locations in the Balkans, in Anatolia, and in the Levant, specifically in the three largest vilayets that hosted the most refugees, the vilayets or the provinces of Danube, Sivas, and Damascus. And so I was mining the archives with an eye to those locations. But what I didn't expect to find when I set out to do my field work was private letters. I also didn't know that I would have access to land records. And those types of documents really gave me the kind of detail that allowed me to zero in on certain themes for each of my case studies. So for example, for Central Anatolia, I could tell a family story of a family buying land and homeschooling their children and how they thought about reconstructing the Circassian village. And then for Jordan, thanks to land records, I could reconstruct the origins of Amman as a refugee village through business transactions on the land and on the buildings. So when something emerges unexpectedly from archival fieldwork, that's one of the best things a historian can experience.
Sure. No, I mean, it's quite impressive. And I mean, the subtlety with which you're able to talk about these different areas as a result of all that is really quite impressive. As you say, you have these different case studies, and I want to come back to Amman in just a second, but the first two case studies you have, Danube province and Sivas province, one thing I thought they had in common was that these settlement projects seem to be characterized by particular tensions between the refugees and the populations with which they're interacting there. So what were some of the tensions in these first two examples that you discuss in the book? And what do they tell us about this larger project that the Ottomans were trying to carry out at this point?
Yeah, the main tension throughout refugee resettlement was over land. When refugees settled on the land, it was given to them for free by the Ottoman government, right? Within the Ottoman refugee regime, specifically through the immigration law of 1857. And my book pushes the usual boundaries between refugee and immigrant and emigrant and settler. Because from the perspective of refugees' neighbors, be they Greeks, Armenians, Bulgarians, Turks, Kurds, Druze, Muhajirs were, of course, settlers. The government claimed that this land belonged to the state, but neighboring communities didn't feel that way and often considered themselves dispossessed in favor of refugees. The Ottoman government settled Muslim refugees in specific parts of the empire with internal colonization in mind. The refugees were supposed to fulfill certain roles that would ultimately benefit the Ottoman state. So what were those objectives? The Ottomans wanted refugees to become farmers and to boost Ottoman agriculture. But they also wanted refugees to help the Ottomans bring nomadic territories under Ottoman control and extend Ottoman sovereignty to territories in Anatolia and the Levant that the Ottomans claimed to control but didn't really control. And then after the Treaty of Berlin in 1878, the Ottoman government was pretty explicit about altering demographic ratios in the borderlands, specifically increasing Muslim populations in Greek and Armenian areas. This is an important part of the story. Resettlement of Muslim refugees went hand in hand with the displacement and murder of Ottoman Christians, including by the 1910s in the Armenian genocide. So throughout the empire, refugees and their neighbors were contesting land, either through Sharia courts and land registries or through fighting. Okay, with all of that in mind, what happened in the Balkans and in Danube province and in Sivas province, and how were they different? So in the Balkans, in the 1860s, the Ottoman government settled up to 300,000 Circassians. Muslim refugees are often seen as perpetrators in Balkan historiography. And that is because in 1876, there was the April uprising of the Bulgarian National Movement, and the Ottoman government violently suppressed it with the help of local Muslim militias. And many of those militias, Başıbozuk, were made up by the outsiders, by Circassian refugees. Then Russia invaded under the pretext of protecting Balkan Christians, starting the Russo-Ottoman War of 1877-78. And during that war, sectarian violence was in full swing. Muslim refugees were seen as aggressors and enforcers of the Ottoman state. And by the time Bulgaria gained autonomy and Romania and Serbia gained independence in 1878, virtually all Circassian refugees were expelled from the Balkans. They fled and they were not allowed to come back. So what interests me is how the sectarian violence came about. And I look to the political economy of refugee resettlement. I find that violence started as economic in nature. It was about inequality and it was about a complete collapse of refugee economies by the 1870s because they were not set up to succeed. There are two main reasons why the economy of hundreds of refugee villages in the Balkans unraveled. Like, first is the funding. The Ottomans didn't have the money to properly fund refugee resettlement. They spent so much money on transporting people from the ports to the villages in the interior, but then the Ottoman government would leave. And refugees were left to fend for themselves. By the 1870s, refugees' tax exemptions were expiring. They had to start paying taxes, but they didn't grow enough crops to support themselves. And then the drought hits in the early 1870s. The refugees lose their harvest, and they can no longer rely on state subsidies because the Ottoman state is going bankrupt. So the economy unravels, and many refugees, to survive, join irregular militias, and they engage in banditry against both Christians and Muslims. So this is the economic origin of violence that would eventually become sectarian Christian-Muslim violence. And then another reason is political. So 1860s, 1870s, we have the age of national movements in the Balkans. And when the Bulgarians are advocating for their independence, the Ottoman government settles several hundred thousand outsiders, Muslim refugees. This could only be interpreted by Bulgarians as a plot to change demographics and to strengthen Ottoman rule. And even more so, Bulgarians were losing their land. They were dispossessed, their land was given to refugees, and sometimes Bulgarian farmers had to build houses for them. So refugee resettlement couldn't really succeed in those circumstances. Refugees were dropped into this volatile political environment, which was not of their doing, and they also were made reliant on the state. The state that was seen as an occupying force by many Balkan Christians, and the state that couldn't really provide for refugees. So that's the story of the Balkans and why everything comes to an end in 1878. Now, in Anatolia, things were different. So the Ottomans settled many North Caucasians of different ethnic groups in the Sivas province, right in the middle of the empire. I'm looking at the region of Uzun Yayla, which to this day is known by many in Turkey as Küçük Kafkasya, or the Little Caucasus. There were 40,000 refugees who set up over 70 villages, North Caucasian villages. So in a way, Circassians and Chechens and Abkhazians reconstructed their homeland high in this mountain valley in the center of Anatolia. But there was also tension over land, because land is never empty. Someone always claims the land. And in Uzun Yayla, there were Afshars, Turkic-speaking nomads who long claimed this plateau as their summer pasture. Afshars would spend winters in Adana province, above Çukurova, and then in the summer, they would move their herds of horses and sheep to the cooler climate of Uzun Yayla. So in the early 1860s, Afshars were returning back for the summer, and then they found thousands of North Caucasian refugees camping out in their valley. The conflict was inevitable. The Afshars and the North Caucasians were fighting in Uzun Yayla over their rights to the valley. And in this moment, the Ottoman government chose to intervene and to back up the refugees. It wasn't really a difficult choice for Istanbul. The Ottomans were trying to sedentarize the Afshars for several decades now. So it was part of the plan. And also, Uzun Yayla became the most popular destination for North Caucasians. So the refugees throughout the empire were watching at how the situation unfolds and what the government's response would be. Refugees wanted the government to defend their rights to the land that it had promised them. And the government did. It pulled up the military from surrounding provinces. Then the governor of Sivas personally arrived in the valley and forced the two sides to make peace. The government was hardly impartial. It pressured the Afshars to cede the claims to Uzun Yayla and to make peace with the refugees. And then in the following years, the government forcibly resettled the nomads outside of Uzun Yayla. So it's one of those rare cases in late Ottoman history when the government directly intervened to back up the refugees. Usually the government would just let refugees fight it on their own over the land. But here, the survival of an entire refugee community was at stake, and the state's authority was at stake. So we have two different stories, in the Balkans and in Anatolia. They both illustrate the power of Muslim refugee resettlement to change political and economic dynamics on the ground, and ultimately either weaken Ottoman rule or strengthen it. But the government's response, what the government was willing or not willing to do, was critical in both stories.
So perhaps I should put it a little bit differently. Not that the tensions were always leading to bad outcomes for the refugees. In Sivas, it seems that the refugees were able to turn the situation to their advantage. By that same token, in Amman, it does seem to have been a more successful experience, perhaps less tension-filled. But maybe we should talk about that a little bit more. Maybe that's oversimplifying it a bit. How did the refugee experience in Amman differ from these other experiences we've talked about?
Amman is a unique case, of course. Amman, now the capital of Jordan, was founded by Circassian refugees in 1878. And it could be regarded as a quintessential story of refugee success. So Kassian refugees arrived in this pretty harsh environment on the edge of the Syrian desert. They survived. They eventually built a village, and then within a generation, transformed their village into this boom town on the nomadic frontier. And I'm reconstructing the story in my book through land registers and court records. Between 1878 and World War I, Circassians and Chechens built 8 villages in Transjordan. 3 of the 4 largest cities in Jordan today were founded by Circassian and Chechen refugees. Today, Amman is the largest city not only in Jordan, but in the Levant. It recently overtook Damascus and Aleppo. By 1914, it had 5,000 residents, most of whom were Circassian refugees. So here in Jordan, Circassian refugees also had to fight over the land. The issue of land was contentious. And from the perspective of local Bedouin communities, North Caucasians were unwelcome outsiders. There are 2 reasons why Amman's story is different. First, Circassian refugees made a strategic alliance with the Bani Sakhar. The Bani Sakhar are one of the largest nomadic confederations in the area. And in the late 1890s, the Bani Sakhar and the Circassians concluded a defensive alliance, which required each party to support the other in case of attack by rival Bedouin communities. This alliance bolstered the security of travel in Jordan, and it's still commemorated by both communities. It was even symbolically renewed in 2013. But because of this alliance, the Bani Sakhar became mediators for Circassians. So there was another conflict between Circassians of Amman and the Balkawiya nomadic confederation, and the Bani Sakhar helped to mediate. A part of this alliance was also an economic partnership. The Circassians were storing Bedouins' grain in their villages and were also helping to resell that grain to Levantine Syrian and Palestinian merchants. So this alliance was really critical for the rise of the refugee village of Amman as a marketplace where refugees, Arab merchants, and the Bedouin could come together and trade. That both communities later in the 1920s forged good relations with the Hashemite family further helped to cement that alliance as a political foundation of Amman. So that's one thing. The second reason is the infrastructure, the Hejaz Railway. Refugees massively benefited from the Hejaz Railway, which the Ottomans built to connect Medina to Damascus and then eventually to Istanbul. And this railway connected Amman to Damascus in 1903. It was a prestige project for the empire. It was the only railway in Ottoman history built solely on Ottoman capital. The railway increased investment in the region. Palestinian and Syrian merchants arrived to buy local wheat, and then they stayed in the Circassian village of Amman. Circassians were selling them shops and houses. Many of the merchant families from Damascus and Nablus became the economic elite of Amman, and they're among the richest families of Jordan until this day. This railway, it helped not only Circassian refugees in their villages, but it also lifted up Bedouin communities and many Transjordanian fellahin who got to benefit from it. So the story of refugee settlement in Jordan is fascinating because good things here came together. Refugees benefited from the land code of 1858. They received very generous land allotments, and they also carefully recorded their land transactions in land registries and in Sharia courts. They also made strategic decisions about their alliances and about their communal defense. And then there's the Ottoman state. The Ottoman state was not very heavily present in Jordan, but it built the railway, which completely transformed the economy of the entire region.
Huh. Now, in addition to these case studies we've been talking about, you're also making another argument as well about how these different case studies, these different regions that we aren't even covering here, how during the 1800s and the early 1900s, the refugees are forming a sense of community, right? So maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the institutions or the debates, the media that helped these people form this new sense of community during these years?
When refugees arrived in the Ottoman Empire, they came from different communities. They spoke different languages of the Caucasus, and often they didn't know each other. For many refugees, they only met other Circassians speaking different dialects, and Chechens, and Abkhazians, and Dagestanis in diaspora. So the first generation really focused on survival. Refugees were scattered throughout the Middle East and the Balkans, in the countryside. There was little attention on political diaspora building. So how did refugees preserve their culture and their sense of being Circassian and Abkhazian and Chechen? That was done primarily through village networks. So when we as scholars think about the Ottoman Empire, we imagine the familiar map, right, with different provinces and major urban centers. But for North Caucasian refugees, that's probably not how they experienced the Ottoman Empire. Most refugees lived in villages deep in Anatolia and in Syria and the Balkans. They would leave their village only to visit other villages where their co-ethnic refugees lived. They traveled to those villages to visit relatives, to trade, to find a spouse. Those ethnic village networks was how refugees experienced the Ottoman Empire. And those ties really helped them to preserve their languages and customs, like deep into the 20th century until today. So there were several specific cultural institutions that refugees transplanted from the Caucasus to the Ottoman countryside that helped them to preserve their culture. And I want to mention one of them, which is the set of unwritten moral codes, because it's a very unique cultural tradition for the North Caucasus. They were unique to each ethnic group, but also there was some overlap. These moral codes are known as Adige Habze for Circassians, Apswara for Abkhazians, Nohchala for Chechens, Ahdau for Ossetians. Each community's moral code incorporated mythologies and prehistories, but also prescribed certain gender and class hierarchies and wedding etiquette and all kinds of behavioral norms. Those moral codes were not customary laws because refugees also arrived with their own adat, customary legal traditions. These moral codes provided ethical guidelines that made one a Circassian or an Ossetian or a Chechen. And again, they're still crucial to this day. In addition to that, there were some physical institutions that helped refugees survive. There's this institution of a guest house, Hachesh, very important for Circassians. Every Circassian family used to have one. And travelers passing through a Circassian village could stay in this guest house for free, using the hospitality of their hosts. But in diaspora, guest houses became something very important. They became sites of transmission of communal knowledge, of songs, of dances, for which many North Caucasians are famous, also sites of communal decision-making for refugee communities. Okay, so when it came to publicly articulating their identity, right, the coherence of refugees, everything changes in the early 20th century. And this is the story of the 1908 revolution. The 1908 revolution is a very exciting time. This revolution promises legal equality, political representation, and also demands the government's accountability. The revolution ended the Hamidian censorship of political associations, and it allowed Ottoman subjects to assemble openly. So we have new ethnic organizations emerging throughout the empire for the Bosnians and Albanians, Bulgarians, Armenians, Jews, and others. And so in 1908, the North Caucasians established the Circassian Union and Support Association. And for the next 15 years, this association becomes the main diasporic organization for all refugees from the North Caucasus. This organization proved very influential for North Caucasian society in the Middle East. Many fundamentals of ethnic identification were formulated by this organization before World War I. This association invested time in formulating the diasporic identity, and it promoted a three-part identity. So first, it promoted pride in the ethnic identity, in being Circassian or Chechen or Abkhazian. Second, it promoted pride in being part of the Ottoman nation. They very much emphasized that they're part, right, of the Ottoman Kavmiyet. And then third, pride in being Muslim and belonging to the Ummah, global Muslim community. So this three-part identity pretty much guided how North Caucasian minorities articulated their politics in the post-Ottoman world, in independent Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Israel. So this association also invested in creating scripts for the Circassian language, which was a very fraught and politically charged process. So one question was, should the Circassian script be based on the Arabic script or the Latin script? The former is associated with Ottoman Muslims, the latter with Ottoman Christians. The latter arguably was better for Circassian phonetics, but the former was better known to everyone. Also, what is the Circassian language? Like, which of the many Circassian dialects should be elevated to the literary norm? Who are the Circassians? What about the different communities living between the Abkhazians and Circassians, like Ubykhs and Abazins? Are their languages part of Circassian or Abkhazian or their own languages? There were so many questions that North Caucasian intellectuals had to deal with after 1908. And this is a remarkable case for the study of global diasporas. Usually, diasporas have a good, strong sense of pre-existing identity. And usually diasporas emerge with a strong literary tradition. The formation of the North Caucasian diaspora in the Ottoman Empire is extraordinary because it preceded nation building in the homeland. The North Caucasians had to develop their written culture already in exile, and they had to do it with self-awareness as a multi-ethnic and multilingual diaspora. So again, on the issue of coherence, how did the North Caucasians forge a diasporic identity given that there was so much diversity in their ranks? Well, at first, they promoted the idea of Circassian identity because Circassians were the majority of refugees. The Ottomans called all of them Cherkess anyway, right? So the North Caucasian elites agreed on publicly presenting their demands to the government as Cherkess because they would that would elevate their voices. But then during World War I, the association started promoting a new identity, the North Caucasian identity, a pan-ethnic one that was based on common origin in one region. And that was done because the Ottoman government during World War I hoped that the North Caucasian diaspora would play a role in the North Caucasus should it become free of Russian rule. So it was first a political project by the Ottoman Foreign Ministry, but the idea of North Caucasian identity, which is built on solidarity between Circassians and Chechens and Dagestanis and others, it really lived on and it became a very important part of North Caucasian, of Muhajir diasporic politics in Turkey and in Syria and in Jordan in the 20th and early 21st centuries.
Well, I think in talking about all this, we've hopefully given listeners a good sense of just the range of topics you're discussing in the book. And we've only really scratched the surface of some of these topics. So in the interest of time, I don't think we should go on too much further, but maybe if I could ask just one last follow-up question, which occurs to me as you're talking about this. I was struck reading the book how in these journals that the Caucasian intellectuals are writing in, how central the issue of slavery was or the abolition of slavery. Maybe we could talk about that for just a second, because I did not realize how big an issue that was within the community in this period.
Absolutely. And So slavery, enslavement is a big part of the story and a big part of the book. It shows up in every single chapter. And I was struck that so many primary sources were revealing the extent of enslavement. So as I mentioned, the displacement from the Caucasus reinforced the institution of slavery in the Ottoman Empire. So it did so in two ways. The first way, I already briefly explained, is because there was the humanitarian crisis in the 1860s, and so many people were enslaved, you know, and sold to slave merchants. And then that reinvigorated the institution of Circassian enslavement, primarily in urban households. So that's one part of the story. The second part of the story that is not very well known and is horrifying is the transplanting of different forms of enslavement that were practiced in the Caucasus to the Ottoman countryside. Different North Caucasian communities practiced enslavement, often within the same ethnic group, for centuries. And the Ottomans, they didn't really know about those forms of enslavement, so they missed that part of the story in the 1860s. But then, in the 1870s and later, there are slave revolts breaking out in different parts of Anatolia in the Balkans, usually on a small scale within individual villages. And that's when the Ottoman government realizes that so many refugees who came in are actually enslaved to other refugees. And the Ottomans are in a hard spot because they're getting petitions from both sides. On the one hand, there are Circassian slaveholders, themselves refugees, who would be writing to the Ottoman government saying, well, Ottoman slavery is legal, so these are disobedient slaves who refuse to obey us. You need to back us up. And on the other hand, there are petitions from enslaved individuals saying, we are Muhajir, we are Muslims, why are we enslaved in the Ottoman Empire? Like, you're the Ottoman, the Islamic justice, please help us. And the Ottomans, they usually would back the slaveholders. Sometimes they would pay for the manumission of enslaved individuals, but usually they would back the slaveholders. But that was the legal tension that the Ottomans didn't really resolve until the end of the empire. You could be, so everyone who came in, all the Muslim refugees, they were muhajir, so they were entitled to all those benefits and exemptions and free land. And on the other hand, many of those people turned out to be enslaved, and they came under the category of köle. And so you could be muhajir, but you could also be enslaved within the Ottoman Empire.
Well, see, that's what I mean. There's so many different topics that this book really goes into depth on. So I think readers are going to really enjoy and learn a lot from it. The last thing I'm just curious about asking you is the sort of projects you're working on now that this book is out, are they a continuation of this project, or are they more informed by the themes that you're dealing with in this project?
It is a continuation in many ways. I'm working on a new book, which is a global history of Hijra, or Muslim refugee migration. As I was writing Empire of Refugees, I was struck by the power of terminology of Hijra and Muhajir, and how much this early Islamic vocabulary meant to refugees, which is apparent in their letters, and also how much it meant to the Ottoman state as it framed the refugee policy. So I'm continuing to explore the phenomenon of Hijra in the Muslim world. I hope to look at Muslim displacements not only from the Caucasus, but also from the Balkans to the Ottoman Empire, and also venture beyond World War I and look at Muslim displacement from Central Asia. So I'm interested in what happens to the idea of Hijra when empires transition to nation states, and when ethnicity replaces religion as a dominant category of difference. So right now I'm reading about immigration in the early Turkish Republic. As with Empire of Refugees, I hope that this new project would further bridge the study of the Middle East and broader Eurasia from the Balkans to Central Asia. And I'm committed to placing Muslim displacement into broader conversations in the field of global migration and refugee studies, which has been so centered on Europe and the Atlantic world historically. There is so much work to be done on refugee histories in the Muslim world.
That is a very good point. And this is a very good book for people to start with, I would say, if they're interested in the subject. So yeah, I very much enjoyed it. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about it.
It has been an absolute joy speaking with you, Ruben. Thank you so much. And many thanks to the listeners for tuning in.